The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Hi, this is The Takeaway for Thursday, October 6th, 2016. Remember, keep the conversation going at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks for listening. Evacuation orders are in place in anticipation of historic storm Hurricane Matthew. The orders come from state houses up and down the East Coast and the White House as the deadly hurricane churns its way up the Atlantic at this hour. The violent storm has already taken lives in the Caribbean. Evacuation plans are in action for residents of coastal towns in Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina. Winds and rain are beginning, but the real story of Hurricane Matthew maybe after it leaves and how it demonstrates the impact of sea level rise over the last few decades. This phenomenon suggests we need to find new yardsticks for measuring disasters that are accompanied by enormous surges of water and debris. Rick Lutzick is professor of marine science and director of the Institute of Marine Sciences at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's ready to see what Matthew will be testing this time around on the eastern seaboard.
Well, this storm will start to open the eyes, I think, of folks along the East Coast of just how sea level rise is exacerbating these severe events. Once we're past this and start to assess the damage, then we'll start to say how much worse it is given the sea level rise we've seen over the last couple of decades. And then we'll also look into the future and say our best estimates of sea level rise, how much worse it will be, for example, if this hit in 2050 or 2100. I think it will be very eye-opening.
And will it affect uniformly the Atlantic coast? Are there particular areas because of geology or water tables that have a very different, you know, there's a different impact to be expected?
The areas that will get hit the hardest are the areas where the coastal plain is very flat. And the lowlands of South Carolina, much of North Carolina, the tidewater areas of Virginia, and even up into New Jersey and parts of New York, where the coastal areas, where there's barrier islands and where the land is very flat, it doesn't take much of an elevation increase to have a large extent of flooding. And so those are the areas where it's easiest to see the impacts of sea level rise and how much worse they make events like this when they come through.
Now, it sounds as though the water issues that you're describing and the changes that have taken place over the last few decades and the changes to be expected in the next few really transform the way we need to evaluate storms like this. It's no longer a Category 1 through Category 5 affair. It's a speed of how fast the storm is moving and how large of a water surge there's going to be. The wind is less of an issue, it seems, in this configuration.
Almost independent of sea level rise, but certainly sea level rise is part of it. But we do need to change the way we think about these major hurricane events. We've for so long worried about the winds, and we had a whole category system 1 through 5 that was designed around the winds. The winds are significant. They do a lot of damage, but the majority of the damage, and in particular the loss of life that occurs, is due to the water. It's due to the storm surge in coastal areas. And so we really do have to rethink, refocus, and provide better information on what that surge hazard is. And then, of course, the sea level rise makes that surge hazard worse. So it's both a public information effort specifically associated with the storms and the surge. And then as we plan for the future, particularly as we decide where to build homes and infrastructure and whatnot, that's when we really need to be understanding and factoring in the effects of sea level rise.
Well, we will see what impact Matthew has on development patterns in the South. I mean, affecting those has been the huge argument that's gone on for the last 50 years, but this may tip things into a different way of thinking. But I'm just wondering, you know, forever we've seen these pictures of people putting plywood on their windows. It sounds like that's not the prepare strategy that really is going to help you out here.
Well, So plywood, worrying about winds, that's still a good idea. I mean, the winds still do a lot of damage. And if you want to protect your windows and protect your property, strategies and steps like that are still wise. But the surge is the real killer. And so after you finish putting the plywood up several days in advance, if the authorities tell you, then you should evacuate, because that's the way you can protect your lives. In terms of, again, going forward in terms of planning, the next home that gets built in an area like this needs to be elevated, needs to be above the surge level, because even if you put plywood in your window, if your home goes underwater, and in particular if it gets hit by waves coming in from the ocean, then that plywood is not going to do much good for you.
I mean, for years, people have gone down to the you know, Home Depot and the lumberyard and brought back all kinds of structural enhancements to their homes, including the windows and also sandbagging around their property and then hunkering down. We've reached a point where that is not only risky, but it's a death sentence, that the surge isn't going to be pushed back by any of that. You're going to be trapped.
Yes. There's nothing you can buy at Home Depot that's going to save your life from storm surge. But again, once the event goes by and we have, you know, months and years between these events, that's the time when this understanding of what really does the damage, what causes the loss of life, has to be over and over and over brought to the attention of the public, the officials, so that wise decisions can be made in terms of where people build, how they build, how high they build, and the infrastructure that we put in around them to facilitate their living.
Professor Rick Lutick is a professor of marine science and director of the Institute of Marine Sciences at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He spoke with us from Moorhead City, North Carolina. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Donald thinks that climate change is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. I think it's real.
I do not say that.
And I think it's important that we grip this and deal with it.
Not that anything is very predictable in this 2016 presidential campaign, but it is likely that this issue will be treated with some greater seriousness at the next candidate debate on Sunday. Despite being generally absent from the campaign, polls show that for more than a third of the electorate, who happen to be millennials, human-caused climate change is one of the biggest issues of the campaign. It's still a partisan divide, though, with 75% of Democratic millennials saying there is solid evidence of global warming, compared with only 49% of Republican millennials. That's according to Pew Research. With me now is Alex Buzmosky, strategy director for RepublicEN.org. That's spelled with an E, a conservative clean energy advocacy group. Alex, are conservatives late to the climate change issue, and are you playing political catch-up right now?
Conservatives are late to the party and are alienating a lot of groups that we see Republicans hemorrhaging at the ballot box, moms, millennials, minorities especially.
So what's your argument to the oldsters there in the Republican Party in 2016?
The number you just cited, 49%, it was asked in a different way than most polls ask the question. And we've seen upwards of 83% of conservative millennials acknowledging that human-caused climate change. And there is a real hunger among millennial conservatives for real solutions, to apply their deeply held free enterprise beliefs to the tough challenges of the day and their generation. And climate change is one of those problems. That level of young support among young conservatives rivals the level of support among young liberals for action on climate change, but the policy that the Republicans are offering does not rival that which the Democrats are offering. And the result has been some pretty bad climate policy when you have only one side of the political aisle with a total monopoly on the issue. And the other result is that whereas about 70% of young conservatives trust the Republican Party to handle national security, only about 30% trust the Republican Party to handle climate change. It's the only issue, or one of the only issues, where young conservatives actually trust the Democratic Party more on an issue. And for, you know, the long-term health of conservatism, it's just essential that our lawmakers and leaders start to offer considered policy competition to the environmental left.
It sounds like you would find some common ground when Barack Obama says things like there are job creation opportunities associated with green energy. You would just say it in a slightly different way. Quickly explain how you have the common ground, but you also have a different sort of slant on it.
The major difference is how we would go about approaching the problem. Whereas President Obama has relied on strict federal central planning regulations through the EPA and targeted subsidies, we think conservatives should offer a solution that shrinks government by reforming our regulatory state and that makes people richer instead of poorer by taxing pollution and using that money to increase people's paychecks.
Let me run this by you. I mean, we heard the vice presidential debate the other night. So when Governor Pence says war on coal, war on coal, war on coal, you wince.
That's a dog whistle term. The war on coal is the free market because natural gas and fracking and the human ingenuity that made those things possible is why coal is losing.
So you're a Wisconsin Midwesterner, right?
Yes, sir.
What are you going to do with all that ice fishing equipment this winter?
That's a great question. We've actually lost 11 ice fishing days in Wisconsin since my dad was a kid due to climate change. Yeah, I agree. I think there's a huge appetite among young conservatives especially to offer the country a considered free enterprise approach to climate change. But the problem is no one's going to listen to them until we make our voices heard. Because only the loud voices on the fringe are being heard by lawmakers.
Alex Bosmoski is Director of Strategy and Operations at RepublicEN.org. Did I say that right?
You sure did, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. A call for women to deliver a message of outrage over a proposed abortion ban in Poland's parliament brought hundreds of thousands of women into the streets of Warsaw and other cities, and additional millions expressing their anger over that ban. "I'm a woman, not an incubator," was one of the chants this week, and late this week, the proposed ban was tabled. Poland still has a very restrictive abortion law, but we spoke with a jubilant Agnieszka Solakowski, an activist who helped organize the Black Strike, and Agnieszka Graf, among the most visible feminist activists in Eastern Europe, who today were reveling in a surprising victory.
This has never happened before in the last 20 years in Polish history. We've never had such huge mobilization, and we've never had such a huge threat to women's rights. On the other hand, the bill that was rejected is not the government's bill. They were being pressured by right-wing fundamentalists who are even further to the right than they are. And so they are going to probably propose their own bill now, which they will present as a compromise, but which will in fact be draconian. And the women's movement has to react promptly to that with great force. They will try to probably allow abortion in cases of rape and incest, but ban abortion in cases of fetal damage. And they will try to convince women that this is a compromise.
Ms. Sokolowska, would you say that Poland has been evolving away from a more authoritarian Catholic state since the end of the Cold War, and that this is a reversal?
I'd say it's too early to say that. Right now, we're just observing the awakening of the civic society and the beginning of a really widespread grassroots movement. But it's too early to say that we're reversing anything. It's a long way, really.
In Europe, is there a model for women's rights that a broad community of activists, feminists in Poland would like to see in place in that country? Is it Germany? Is it the Scandinavian countries?
I think Eastern Europe has really a different chronology because we didn't have the 1970s mass women's movements. And so what we're actually doing, I think, now is a new version of that. The women's movement that has been active in the last 20 years was mostly working in NGOs, non-governmental organizations, which were professional and not driven by mass input. This is a completely new phenomenon. You have girls young women, maybe not girls, but mostly young women, getting together on Facebook, women who didn't know each other personally, and some of them still don't know each other personally, and deciding to do something in response to evolving political situation. A group that started, you know, one evening with five women who were angry at the political initiatives of the ruling party evolved overnight into 20,000. And it now has 100,000 people. This is a Facebook group called Girls for Girls. And, you know, there are skeptics who say click activism doesn't achieve anything. But we had 100,000 people in the streets on Monday. So it's obviously working.
Are men involved?
Yes, but I think mostly as helping hands, not as initiators. This really is a massive movement of angry women of all ages, but it's the first time that young girls are mobilized. Warsaw was swarming with young women in black, you know, with their faces painted in war paint, black war paint, carrying really, sometimes really funny banners. And including, you know, quotes from Marley, no women, no country, that sort of thing. And responding in this very colorful way to what's going on. So it's a very spontaneous protest, which is, I think, growing.
Two questions for you, Ms. Sokolovska. Unlike the United States, this isn't a constitutional question. It's not for the courts. It's for the legislature. And I'm wondering if there's a question of votes there. And secondly, what does the Catholic Authority in Poland say about all this versus what appears to be a loosening of restrictions in the Vatican about these kinds of movements?
I'd say that right now they're backing off a little. They just said that they have never supported a punishment of women who perform an abortion, which is really weird to hear from the Catholic Church. But
I think the church is scared by the scale of the protests. They are because the group that is leaving the Catholic Church the fastest in Poland are young women, and they know what happened in Ireland. So I think, you know, at first they may have been happy about this initiative, but now they may be taking a step back.
Well, Ms. Graf, I mean, I can hear it in both of your voices, but definitely in Ms. Sokolovska's voice. I mean, you seem to be having an impact that is surprising even you here. Yes, we're not out of the woods, or at least the feminist agenda here is not out of the woods, but this has taken you by surprise.
Absolutely. It was unexpected. We have never expected it would be so big. Anyone who tried to prepare everything, to prepare the protests, we were expecting maybe 20,000 people, maybe 30. But it turned out that 100,000 people took to the streets, and perhaps another 100,000 supported the protests in their own way. For example, wearing black.
Yeah, if you went to the shops, you know, to restaurants, to schools, all the teachers in my son's school were dressed in black that day. They didn't cancel classes because then the, you know, the school would collapse. But I think this was really huge. The figures are that 6 million people in Poland support the protest.
Agnieszka Graf is a feminist activist and writer in Poland and an American studies professor at the University of Warsaw. Agnieszka Sokolowska is a feminist activist who helped organize Monday's Black Strike protest. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Is Yahoo a good citizen, a clever operator, or a leaky boat as far as privacy is concerned? A report by Reuters says that at the request of the National Security Agency and the FBI, Yahoo developed software to scan hundreds of millions of Yahoo mail accounts, searching for specific sets of characters, phrases, or an email attachment in incoming emails. In 2007, Yahoo had fought a FISA request that it conduct searches on specific email accounts, provided the agencies obtained a warrant. Well, last month, Yahoo admitted that over 500 million accounts were part of a foreign-backed data breach back in 2014. In July, Verizon agreed to buy Yahoo for $4.8 billion. That's some resume. Journalist Kim Zetter covers digital security for The Washington Post, The Intercept, and other publications. Kim, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
What is Yahoo's capability here, and why would they indicate that they have this capability?
It's not really any unusual capability. We've learned a little more with follow-up stories now about exactly what they were doing. What they already had in place a spam filtering and child pornography filtering system, and that sifts through all of the email coming into Yahoo servers in order to, you know, either find child pornography or filter to spam folders. And what they did was they simply tweaked that system, or at least according to reports, that's what they did, to at the same time filter for email that included some identifiers that the government gave Yahoo. And so that's not the same as sort of building a new system and building new capability. It's simply tweaking an existing system.
And this was government initiated. This is not part of Yahoo's development of internal proprietary software that it would use as products to get revenue off of selling data or offering data to the open market.
This was initiated by the government. It was with a court order through the FISA court, and they asked Yahoo to find communications that were using some kind of specific identifiers. We don't know what those identifiers were, but according to reports, they were looking for specific communications from a state-sponsored terrorist group.
So this was confined to a particular case?
Yes, a particular investigation. Although it was sifting through all of the email, the filter would only pull out any email that matched the identifiers that the government gave Yahoo. And then Yahoo would pull that communication aside and send it to a system that the government could then access.
Finally, the other bad story out of Yahoo is, of course, the hack of 500 million pieces of data. Personal accounts. Is it conceivable that the same technology which helps out the NSA here in this particular investigation also enables the hack, that we're looking essentially at the same thing?
No, I mean, that was, you know, getting access to email accounts is, you know, in that case, you're looking at sort of getting into administrative accounts. That wouldn't be the same thing as this, although there are, you know, questions raised about any time Yahoo installs something like this, is it secured in a way that someone couldn't hijack it in order to see what Yahoo is sifting through and giving to the government, or even tweaking what that system is collecting and looking for? And I think that that's one of the questions that was raised in the articles, is that the Yahoo security team discovered this tool on the system and were concerned that it hadn't been locked down in a way that they would expect it to be.
Is Yahoo kind of woohoo? It's open season on data. I mean, is this a level of deteriorated privacy that is out of sync with other big data files that users would be involved in, say Google, Bing, or is this just the future?
I mean, this has been going on for a while. We learned about the PRISM program with the Edward Snowden documents, and
right. That
involves a lot of ISPs handing over data through a court order to the government. Again, the only thing new here is sort of the innovative technique that Yahoo devised on its own, apparently, to deliver the data to the government.
Veteran journalist Kim Zetter has covered cybersecurity for more than a decade for Wired, The Washington Post, The Intercept, and other publications. She spoke to us from Oakland, California. Kim, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
If Yahoo's enormous database is worth hacking, then it is apparently worth selling parts of it on the black market. A contractor with the NSA has been arrested for stealing and leaking classified secrets, in a sense using the NSA as a kind of personal ATM.
We're fuzzy on her.
So we don't really know what anyone is after?
Not really, sir.
The real case might be fuzzier than the movie parody Burn After Reading. The contractor, Harold Thomas Martin, a Maryland resident and Navy veteran, is suspected of stealing classified material like fugitive and accused of espionage individual Edward Snowden, who's holed up in Russia. Martin was employed by Booz Allen Hamilton, a strategy and technology firm with contracts for the U.S. government and defense communities, and a difficult-to-control culture of secrecy, apparently. Scott Shane is national security reporter for our partner, The New York Times. He helped break this story. Scott, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks, John.
So what gives this the importance that we should underscore? Is it the information that was attempted to be sold or was actually sold? Is it the Booz Allen connection here? Is it something about the Navy veteran?
Actually, at this point, we don't know that Hal Martin, as he was known to his friends, was trying to make public the information that he had. All we really know is that the FBI says that over a lengthy period, he used his job as a contractor for the National Security Agency to take home highly classified information, some of it including the tools that NSA uses to break into foreign computing systems in Russia and China and Iran and other places. So very, very highly prized computer code. And but what remains murky is what his intent was. They found thousands of pages of it and dozens of computers and thumb drives and other sort of, you know, digital media in his home and in his car. But, you know, from the looks of it, it doesn't appear that he was trying to hide this particularly. It's possible still, I think, that this is a guy who was he's described to me as a workaholic, and maybe he was bringing his work home and actually had not given any of it away. So that's what the investigation is intended to find out.
So in the one case, it would be like a, you know, Booz Allen version of Hillary Clinton with the servers and computers at home. In another case, it could be he's just a very incredibly sloppy individual who may have compromised security because everything's kind of spread all over the place. But it doesn't appear at this point that he's nefarious and working for foreign operators.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things that's interesting here is that since Edward Snowden made public or gave to journalists hundreds of thousands of very highly classified NSA material in 2013, there have been other leaks from NSA. Stuff has gone up on WikiLeaks site. Other material went up in other places attributed to a group calling itself the Shadow Brokers. The FBI has been hard at work trying, and NSA has been trying to figure out who is leaking this stuff. So when they found a guy who was taking all this material home, they clearly got extremely concerned. But it's not clear yet that he is the source of those leaks. If he's not, that means there are still other people out there leaking from NSA.
So he's possibly collateral damage from investigations that are much wider, that are taking a look at the vulnerability of the NSA in a broad sense. Scott Strain, correct?
That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, this administration, the Obama administration, has prosecuted 8 people for leaking classified information to the press. But apparently it has not deterred all the people who want to put out classified information.
Great stuff. Scott Strain, New York Times national security reporter. Thanks as always.
Thank you, John.
A human need is a need, regardless of the awkwardness required to discuss it sometimes.
OB, it's the way you should be. Keep it simple and set yourself free from the extra that you really don't need. Just try OB and you'll see.
Vivid, high-profile commercials for menstrual products are a relatively recent arrival from the world of glossy women's magazines and high school health classes. Be active, jump rope, dance, chat on the phone. With super-absorbent tampons, you can escape from the women's curse, the scourge of uncleanliness and foul moods. Just carry modern menstrual products and you're free, as long as you have a pharmacy or bodega nearby. This is an image associated with the affluent, though. There are lots of women who don't have access to feminine products. Homeless women or the poor can't afford tampons and pads. Several U.S. states impose a so-called tampon tax, a tax that is placed on feminine hygiene products, even though they aren't luxuries.
So in the spring of my freshman year of high school, my mom lost her job, and within weeks it became too expensive to stay in our apartment. So we really had no choice but to move out and enter, you know, a time of transition, and that's what I call it, which was essentially several months of couch surfing with our closest friends who have since become family.
So young Nadia Akimoto is a millennial who, along with a number of other people from around the world, has adopted a cause to ambitiously pursue to change the world. After interacting with other women who were homeless and learning that so many of them couldn't afford the most basic feminine hygiene products, she had her cause and says It went well beyond one shelter she visited. So in high school, she founded Commions of Care, a nonprofit that distributes menstrual hygiene products to needy women and girls. A passionate essay she wrote about the challenges that homeless women can face with menstrual hygiene was recently featured in a series called Ambitions Interrupted. The series was produced by the Ground Truth Project and its Youth Voices Initiatives, which profiles young people as fired up as Nadja.
Like, seriously, world? Girls and women have been menstruating since the beginning of time,
right?
And all of us experience it on a monthly basis for 40 years, so why is it still holding girls back? Like, why is this natural need still being unaddressed to the point that it's literally, I really think it's a hindrance to global development, because if you think of global development as something we're all striving to reach in breaking the cycle of poverty and advancing families, the best way to do that is through women's empowerment right now, to make sure that 100% of our population is fully contributing to the best of their ability. And the way we empower women is through education and economic purpose. But women and girls are not being able to take full advantage of that right now because of the stigma around menstruation, the cultural practices that often go along with a woman having their period, or even here in the States, women and girls simply not having access to feminine hygiene products.
Have you ever met a homeless person who says to you, you know, people keep giving me food and money, but what I really need are some tampons? I mean, is that...
That is something we hear on a regular basis.
Really?
It is. It so is. And actually, we have a contact form on our website where people can just send us things. And it is amazing how many notes we get that just say, thank you, I'm either homeless or was previously homeless, and I've always wanted feminine hygiene products, and I felt like there wasn't an advocate around there. Because when you say hygiene products and you think of what someone needs to feel clean, right? You don't think of periods.
But it's a design question. I mean, it would be great if society at large,
yes,
was more sensitive to the needs,
oh,
for women to deal with this every month. Even the fact that there are lots of pharmacies around doesn't,
yeah,
necessarily mean that, you know, women don't have to drop what they're doing to deal with the fact that this isn't something that kind of,
yes,
drops out of the cupboard where it should.
Yeah. Well, and it's not even that. You have to think about the cost that goes into it. Even if it's 25 cents, that's money that can be used for something else, especially when someone is really socioeconomically disadvantaged. Even if it is a low cost, that low cost could be used for something much more. And when you think of someone who's, even in America, who's living in a way where every penny counts, other needs that come into play are food and water and shelter, or clothing, especially,
right,
when it comes to winter. So menstrual hygiene products is not often prioritized above those things. And women are then often resorting to using toilet paper and most commonly brown paper grocery bags, from what we've talked to them about. And using brown paper grocery bags just has a lot of risk in terms of skin infections or just the general discomfort of it. And actually, what we hear about a lot is the emotional effect of having to use brown paper grocery bags that you found on the street in your vaginal area to maintain menstrual hygiene. There's a lot of self-consciousness that's elevated in that sense of, what do I smell like? Does it look okay? This is really uncomfortable. And, you know, this stigma really goes to anyone experiencing their period. So any woman or girl or transgender female, for that matter.
All right. So what are you going to be doing in 5-10 years with this project, do you think?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I often get the question of, what is the end goal with your organization? And for me right now, and maybe you can tell from how I talk about it, but I just get so excited about it. And I think that the end goal is really fighting until menstrual hygiene and natural needs isn't something that holds anybody back, because a natural need is something that deserves to be addressed. And menstrual hygiene is not a privilege. It's a right. And I don't know if that'll happen in my generation, but right now I don't perceive any stopping anytime soon.
All right. Well, thanks so much for taking,
absolutely,
the time here, and congratulations on all your great work. And it's been wonderful talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You can read Nadja Akimoto's essay on the Takeaway's website. It's one of 35 essays that were selected for the series Ambitions Interrupted. The series was produced by the Ground Truth Project and its Youth Voices Initiative. Ground Truth is based at our partner, WGBH in Boston. With all of the mystery of a papal elevation, the United Nations Security Council, along with Russia and the United States, agreed unanimously to appoint Portugal's Antonio Guterres as the next UN Secretary General. The former Prime Minister of Portugal, has served as High Commissioner for the UN Refugee Agency for the past decade. A formal vote will ratify the nomination, and Guterres will become the 9th UN Secretary General, meaning once again, the Secretary General will not be a woman. Dr. Jean Krasno is a former executive director of the Academic Council on the UN System and is currently a tenured lecturer at the Colin Powell School for Civic and Global Leadership at the City College of New York. Even though this year the UN tried to make the replacement of Ban Ki-moon more like a traditional open ballot, Jean Krasno says an opportunity was missed.
We are just terribly disappointed that it's not a woman.
How does the process work here? It doesn't seem like it's an elective position. It's more like appointed by some big shots at the UN.
This particular year for the election of the Secretary General, it has been more transparent. Prior to this, it was completely secretive. Nobody knew anything until the final name was announced. But the General Assembly last year demanded to have a greater role. And so they passed a resolution saying candidates should be nominated by countries and that all candidates would have an open hearing at the UN. And that has happened. So we've been able to meet all the candidates. There have been 13, 7 women, 6 men. And it's been a great experience for the women to get to be known by the public, to express their ideas, and for us to see how outstanding they are. However, they didn't prevail.
What did you advocate as far as having a woman be Secretary General, and who were the candidates?
Our purpose was to get a woman elected, so we were not backing any particular woman because, as we saw when the process evolved, some women dropped out. A new candidate came on just last week, so we felt that we had to stay open in terms of who it would be. But we felt very strongly that the UN is now 71 years old. There had never been a woman Secretary General. There have been 8 men. They've all been very good. I have no problem with that. But women make up more than half the world's population, and they have not had a voice at the top.
Although beyond that, isn't it also the case that the UN deals with, in a lot of its cultural and health-related programs, issues of great importance to women all around the world, and that to not have a woman at that sort of senior level is an omission at this point, as opposed to purely just balancing the ticket?
Absolutely. It's not just a matter of gender equity, which is, of course, something that we advocate, but women are refugees. They have to take care of their families, their children. They're fleeing awful conflicts or earthquakes, and there's no one to listen to their needs. And we envisioned a woman Secretary General going around the world, visiting parliaments, visiting villages, visiting refugee camps, and sitting down and listening to what women needed. And then also saying, you also can be a part of the decision-making process. I'm here to show you that you can, as women, do that. And now we've missed that.
Critics of Ban Ki-moon and some of the more recent secretaries general have said that the profile has not been high enough to deliver the power that the UN needs to have to move the needle in countries around the world where, as you say, the refugee crisis is a huge problem. Do you think it is the case? And can you give me an example of a woman who has the political oomph and stature to really raise the profile of the Secretary General like it was in the past, the Dag Hammarskjöld, some of the characters who we know in history really were global figures?
Yes. I mean, I think the women candidates who got into the process, several of them were outstanding in that way. And what's frustrating is that women are held to a higher standard. And then they don't tell us what the standard is.
Who is someone that we should watch?
We felt that Irina Bokova, who is the Director General of UNESCO, was a fantastic candidate. And she was generally one of the higher women in these results, as there were 6 straw polls. And also the latecomer, Kristalina Georgieva, fantastic, brilliant, articulate, charismatic, and yet has this human quality to her.
Do you think that there was a veto here, that Bukova particularly was someone who the Russians would not have wanted, and that the U.S. compromised, and that there was some backroom deal?
There was definitely a backroom deal. I don't know what the backroom deal was, but Russia turned its back on its own region. It abandoned its own constituency, Eastern Europe. When I met with Ambassador Churkin about a year ago, he said, it has to be from Eastern Europe. And he gave me a list of every region that had been represented, and he absolutely pounded the table and said, it has to be Eastern Europe. And then he didn't do it.
What do we know about Guterres? I mean, yes, our disappointment, or your disappointment, is palpable and certainly worth speaking about, and will concern many, many women around the world. But nevertheless, we do need to know who this candidate, now Secretary General, is.
Yes. Well, he was Prime Minister of Portugal, and then was the High Commissioner for Refugees for two terms, which just ended a short time ago. So he is highly respected.
And that's an argument in his favor, given the refugee crisis.
Yes, yes. You know, but it would have been nice if he had done a little bit more early warning for the rest of us and warned us what was going to happen, because he had his eye on the camps and he should have been telling us so that something could be done to alleviate the situation within the camps. I don't want to take away from him, because he is going to be our leader, and I support the UN, and you know, we will support him. But, you know, there are issues that I'm concerned about.
And how do you take this back to your academic responsibilities? Does this become a setback, you tell your students? Is this a bad moment in the history of the United Nations, or we just go on for another day?
Well, I've been teaching courses on the UN and international law for over 20 years. At Yale University, at City College, and I also teach at Columbia. It's reality. It's a reality check that there is still a lot of discrimination against women, that people don't believe that a woman can really be a leader. I mean, I'm firmly convinced that women can be wonderful leaders, but there's still a lot out there who don't believe that.
Jean Krasno is a tenured lecturer at the Colin Powell School of Civic and Global Leadership at City College here in New York, former executive director of the Academic Council on the United Nations System. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today. After an hour of the consideration of, I think we can agree, worthy, if ambitious, causes, there's a report in The New Yorker that at least two very rich Silicon Valley billionaires are trying to resolve the age-old question, what if everything we see in reality is actually just an illusion? How can we know that we aren't living in some simulated matrix? Question posed by Pink Floyd years ago. I kid you not. The numbers are sketchy and the names, but why not just give me $1 billion, guys, and I'll put it to some really worthy cause. I'll change reality, and then you'll have a little more data, and I'll have more money. Real win-win all the way around. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry, just trying to help. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.